Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and thanks for joining us today on If You Love This Planet. I'm interviewing Richard Heinberg, Senior Fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and widely regarded as one of the world's foremost peak oil educators. Richard Heinberg is the author of 8 books, including The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World, The Oil Depletion Protocol, and Peak Everything. Richard Heinberg writes a regular column for The Ecologist and also has authored scores of essays and articles that have appeared in such journals as The American Prospect, Public Policy Research, Quarterly Review, Z Magazine, Resurgence, The Futurist, European Business Review, and many others. He's appeared in numerous video documentaries, including Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour. Richard Heinberg now joins me from Santa Rosa, California. Welcome, Richard. Well, I'm just updating my book, If You Love This Planet, that I wrote in 1991. And my God, the world has changed since then. I mean, scientists were predicting global warming, predicting not the end of oil at that time, but food shortages, overpopulation, toxic pollution, deforestation, of course, all of which has come to pass.
It's all happening, isn't it?
And at the time, I also wrote about the free trade agreement, WHO, which has just collapsed yesterday at Doha, the Doha round, because the poor countries don't like being exploited by the rich. So it all interdigitates, I think, with the oil problem. And two of your papers I found absolutely fascinating. One was The View from Oil's Peak, and one is What Will We Eat When the Oil Runs Out? So let's first talk about peak oil, because I don't think many people understand the concept or
sure.
where we are or how extraordinarily dependent society is upon oil.
Sure. Well, we're not talking about actually running out of oil, because there's still lots of oil out there in the ground waiting to be extracted and used. What we're talking about is the moment when the rate of flow of oil to the market is going to inevitably start to wane. And we know that's going to happen because it happens in individual oil fields. There's a kind of bell-shaped curve of recovery over time from individual oil fields and whole oil-producing nations. Right now, most countries in the world that produce oil are past their national oil production peaks, and that's famously the case with the United States, which used to be the world's foremost oil-producing nation. It hit its peak in 1970 and has been declining ever since. And now we have whole regions like the North Sea, which has been developed by Great Britain and Norway primarily. And North Sea oil peaked around 1999-2000, and already Britain's oil production is down to about half of what it was at that time. Britain, which experienced an economic miracle as a result of North Sea oil back in the 1980s and 90s, has now become a net oil importer again. So every year there are fewer countries that are able to export oil and more countries that want to import oil. What's even worse is that the countries that still do export oil are seeing some of the highest rates of increase in domestic demand for oil. Now, that's really not hard to understand when you think about it, because these oil exporting countries with the high oil prices we're seeing now are earning enormous amounts of foreign exchange income. That's causing their economies to expand. And in expanding economies, of course, people buy cars and drive further. So countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia, United Arab Emirates, Iran, these are the countries that are seeing some of the highest rates of growth in domestic demand for oil, which means that before they can export any oil, they have to satisfy that domestic demand. So there's less available on the world export market. This has been a trend over the last about 3 years. Globally, oil production has been just about stagnant for the last 3 years. That doesn't necessarily mean that we've reached the all-time global oil production peak, but we're certainly very close to it if we're not already there. But we've already certainly reached the peak of available exports. And for countries that import a lot of oil, like the United States and also China, India, and others we could mention, this is very bad news. The U.S., of course, is the world's champion oil importing nation. We import twice as much as the next two nations in line, which are China and Japan, put together. And so as oil becomes more expensive, that this puts pressure on just about every industry, but first in line is the airline industry, the automobile industry, trucking, and agriculture. And so the global economy is teetering right now. Certainly the U.S. economy is leading the way, and that's only partly because of high oil prices, but certainly high oil prices are taking their toll.
Yes, and the markets react too, I mean, to perception. And as the oil price goes up, so the markets react, and then if it goes down, they heave a sigh of relief, a few dollars,
right,
and they're into it again. But it interests me that you said that the exporting countries are declining in their production of oil, partly because they haven't kept up with the technology to extract the oil, partly because they're using it themselves. And you said of the 51 producing nations in the world, 27 have reported declines,
right,
for various reasons. And then you said there was a man called M. King Hubbard, who in 1956 forecast that the U.S. production would peak within a few years. And in fact, it did.
Right.
And then there's another guy called Richard Dafis, who in 2005 said that we had probably already reached peak oil, or would reach it in 2005. From your knowledge, Richard Heinberg, where do you think we are at realistically now?
Well, we are in the peaking period. M. King Hubbard, who you mentioned, was probably the most important geophysicist of the 20th century. He was responsible for many advances in knowledge in that field. But from a practical standpoint, certainly his greatest contribution was he was the first geologist or geophysicist to really understand the process of oil depletion. And it was on that basis that he forecast the U.S. oil production peak in 1970. He also forecast that global oil production would peak around 2000. But, of course, it didn't. However, I think the reason he was wrong is largely because we saw the oil shocks of the 1970s driving up prices and causing nations to conserve and use a lot less oil. If that hadn't happened, we probably would have seen the global peak around 2000. Ken DeFaze, who was a student of and co-worker of M. King Hubbard, is the one who says that we probably peaked around 2005. That may end up being true on an averaged annualized basis, but we are still seeing occasional monthly production above what we saw in May 2005, which for many months was our peak month of production. But in a way, it doesn't matter. All that's technical. What really matters is the fact that we have reached this plateau where the world isn't producing any more oil, and it's going to be all downhill from here. If we're seeing oil prices in the range of $120 to $150 a barrel right now, it's going to be much higher in years to come because global oil production is going to decline, and it will decline significantly.
Well, tell us then, Richard Heinberg, sort of give us a brief summation of how, let's use the U.S. as a prototype, how society uses oil in its many ramifications and how dependent we are upon oil, because I don't think many people really realize the depth of dependency that we have.
Sure. Well, first of all, we primarily use oil as a source of energy. We also use oil as a feedstock for chemicals and plastics and pharmaceuticals and all sorts of things. And those are very important uses of oil, and they are extremely important to our economy. Even fabrics are made out of petrochemicals. Mm. So, you know, most of us are surrounded by oil-based products from the moment we get up in the morning till we go to bed at night. But it's really as a source of energy that oil is most important to us, because energy is what makes things happen. Without energy, we wouldn't have an economy. It's not that the economy is, you know, partly based on energy, you know, because we spend a certain fraction of our GDP directly on energy. If we didn't have the energy for transporting goods, for manufacturing goods, the entire economy would come to an abrupt halt. So energy is the basis for modern life as we know it. And the whole reason for the Industrial Revolution and modern industrial societies is that we found this amazingly compact, potent form of energy that we hadn't been able to use before. Fossil fuels have an enormous energy wallop compared to wood and muscle power, which is what we had depended on for centuries and millennia previously.
Mm.
And it's enabled things like urbanization. You know, it used to be that 80-90% of the population had to be involved in food production.
Mm,
But now with tractors and other mechanized farm machinery and the ability to transport food ever further, well, in this country, in the United States, only about 2% of the population produces the food for everybody else. And therefore, we have the phenomenon of urbanization and the growth of the middle class and the growth of all kinds of job opportunities that could never have existed if we didn't have this cheap energy. So if energy becomes more expensive, that undermines all economic activity. And oil is the world's foremost energy source, and it's responsible for about 95% of transportation energy.
Yes, I think we should at this point just define oil is used for all those mechanisms that you've just described, but on the whole it's not used for generating electricity, which is another form of energy, and that's coal or
yes.
hydro, or if I say nuclear, and you know my attitude about nuclear.
So
there are two forms of fossil fuel that are used widely and extensively, both of which are causing global warming.
That's
the electricity
right.
production with coal and everything else with oil, right? And coal will
yes.
last forever, really.
Well, I'm actually writing a book on global coal supplies right now.
Oh, yeah.
And it's pretty astounding that the most recent studies are suggesting that the extent of global coal supplies is much smaller than we have been led to believe.
Oh, that's interesting.
And this has some amazing ramifications. We've been thinking about coal in terms of what's called the reserve-to-production ratio. In other words, we estimate how much coal there is out there and how much of that we'll be able to extract. We call those reserves, and then we divide that by how much we're actually using on an annual basis, and we get, you know, 200 years worth of coal
yep.
or 250 years.
Yeah.
But those reserve to production ratios are completely useless for forecasting future supplies because, you know, we never use a resource at a constant rate until one day suddenly it runs out.
Yep.
We should be thinking in terms of this peaking phenomenon, as I was describing with regard to oil. And when we apply that kind of peaking analysis to coal, and only a few studies have done this, the surprising result is we're likely to see a peak in global coal production in as soon as 20 years from now.
Huh.
And with China, the peak is going to come much sooner, probably within just a few years. And, of course, this has enormous economic ramifications for China, which is getting something like 80% of its total energy from coal. Now, this could be good news for climate, except for one thing, which is that we've underestimated climate sensitivity.
Yeah.
In other words, we've been thinking that, you know, if we have 2 degrees of warming and we can keep to 450 parts per million of CO2, then we can avoid catastrophic climate change.
Yeah.
But all the latest data suggests that that's not true, that in fact a single degree of warming has already led us to the brink of catastrophic climate change. And so we really can't afford to burn any more coal.
That's right, or oil, in fact. I mean,
yes.
as I look at this as a physician with the planet that's a patient, in the intensive care unit unless we act immediately. We're in catastrophic strife, right?
I'm afraid so. We have understandably gotten hooked on fossil fuels because they have been so powerful a source of energy and so cheap and so abundant. But we're just starting to realize what an enormous environmental human health cost is associated with that that dependency.
Yes, well, I interviewed James Hansen from NASA, the leading meteorologist, really,
that's
and
right.
climate expert, and of course, that's what he's been writing about. And he predicted this actually 20 years ago when he coined the phrase global warming. I'm interviewing Richard Heinberg, who's an expert in peak oil. So, Richard, okay, so as you describe peak oil, peak coal, and we superimpose upon those problems to society in the global economy, the global warming problem and the catastrophe that awaits us if we don't stop burning both coal and oil now. Let's just go back to the ordinary sort of Mr. and Mrs. Joe Blow living in the suburbs in America and how their lives are totally, and their economy, totally dependent upon oil. And you've written about that.
Right. Well, it's a systemic dependency. It's not something that's going to be easy to undo overnight.
Mm.
But it's something that we have to address immediately, and for the two reasons we've already outlined, from an environmental, a moral standpoint, we have to address our fossil fuel dependency because of the impact on the global climate. But even if we find that to be economically onerous, as many policymakers worldwide are saying, even if we don't want to think about future generations and the fate of the Earth, the fact is that fossil fuels are becoming scarce and expensive in real time. And so our dependence on those fossil fuels is an enormous economic vulnerability for our entire society. So we really have no choice. We have to reduce our reliance on these fuels, and that's going to require a lot of fast work, investment, and ingenuity. Because even though there are alternative energy sources out there, currently we're getting 85% of our energy from fossil fuels, and we have trillions of dollars invested in an energy infrastructure and a transport infrastructure that's based on these fuels.
Yeah. Even freight now is transported on trucks and not rails, which are so much more efficient.
That's right.
Per ton than the trucks on the roads. Well, see, it kind of comes back, and I can't help thinking as a physician and etiology, the cause of the whole thing and how to fix it, the cure, to the scientific knowledge and the vision of politicians and I guess their constituents. So let's look at that for a minute. How do you see politicians reacting to this? Are they really aware of what you're talking about? Let alone the constituency?
I would say very few politicians understand the role that depletion is playing in advancing energy prices. And by the way, it's not just oil. We're seeing much higher prices for natural gas and coal as well now. And all fossil fuels are finite, non-renewable, and depleting. And we will be seeing substantial price increases for all of them. Now, again, policymakers really don't understand this. They generally do not have backgrounds in the physical sciences. Most politicians have, if anything, backgrounds in law or economics.
And business, yes.
And these are disciplines that do not prepare them to understand Earth's resources and the process of depletion. There are a few exceptions, and I've spent considerable amount of time over the past few years traveling around and speaking to members of parliament and legislators in all of the countries of the English-speaking world. And I'm happy to say that I've spoken with dozens of these folks who do understand, but even the ones who do are finding it very difficult to make headway in terms of policy because when it comes right down to it, governments are charged with maintaining economic growth as their first priority. And if economic growth comes into conflict with our long-term survival prospects, then it creates a real bind for politicians, because on one hand, if they do the right thing, on the other hand, they're likely to be voted out of office next time around. So it's a very difficult political problem, and I think the only solution will come from educating the public.
Yes.
The people have to understand the
yes.
nature of the situation that we're in, and the dire necessity of reducing our dependence on fossil fuels, even if it does mean that we have to scale back our consumption and even scale back what we would normally think of as our quality of life.
Yes, and then in the capitalist system, which I really do think is leading to the death and destruction of much of life on Earth, actually, if you analyze it, you know, the politicians too are in the pockets of the corporations who dig up the coal. You know, the oil companies are incredibly powerful. And I know ExxonMobil just spent $16 million injecting doubt and skepticism into the notion of global warming.
Right.
So really, in a way, the politicians are more controlled by their donors, contributors, who are the multinationals, than their constituents, who tend to sort of be a bit lackadaisical about voting. Well, should I, shouldn't I? Won't make any difference. And in a certain sense, they're right at
yes.
this point in time, right?
Yes, and we also live in an age when for every expert, there's an equal and opposite expert. You know, if there's a point of view that will benefit a certain segment of society, it's always possible to find someone with some credentials to put forward that point of view. And so we have economists and statisticians like Bjorn Lomborg and others who are effectively saying, oh, there's no limit to Earth's resources, and we should go on using as much as we can. And, of course, politicians love to hear that message because that's, you know, that makes it easy for them. They don't have to actually make any tough decisions. They can just leave it all up to the market and hope that it all sorts itself out.
It seems to me that you, Richard Heinberg, an expert in peak oil and the like, should be writing for the Wall Street Journal and New York Times. You should be on McNeil Lehrer. You should be on Nightline. I'm serious.
That's kind of you to say. Well, it is true that we've seen an enormous shift just over the past year. One good thing about rising oil prices is that it gets people's attention.
Yeah.
And we actually have seen good articles in places like the Washington Post and, well, not so much the Wall Street Journal, a bit here and there, and even the New York Times, about the problem of oil depletion. Now, still, they tend to speak of peak oil as a theory, which I think is very unfortunate because there's very little theoretical about it. It's simply an observation. This is what happens to oil fields and whole oil-producing nations, and it will happen to the world as a whole. There's really no controversy about that. The only controversy, it's actually quite a small one, is, you know, when is it going to happen?
Yes, yes. What's
the timeline? Is it happening now?
Yes.
Or will it happen in 10 or 15 years? And I think the evidence is growing almost daily that the near peakers are right, that the global oil production peak is happening effectively now.
Well, now, so that's going to translate into much, much higher prices. So what's your scenario, Richard Heinberg, of how that will impact society? What can you see apart from chaos?
Well, I think, you know, eventually we will be forced to deal with the problem one way or another. It seems to me from experience so far that policymakers will drag their feet as long as they possibly can. But beyond a certain point, something will have to be done. I think it might be analogous to the Great Depression in the 1930s. You know, when the stock market crashed in 1929, things started to fall apart, but it was 4 or 5 years before the government organized
yeah.
the New Deal
well,
to respond to it.
Well, until Roosevelt was elected, huh?
Yes. And I think, you know, we've seen our 1929 event basically this year with the run-up in oil prices
yeah.
Up to nearly $150 a barrel. The American economy is reeling. The
yep.
airline industry is in on the verge of collapse.
Yep.
Ford and General Motors and Chrysler are about to go bankrupt.
Mm.
And politicians are, rather than dealing with the problem, they're discussing things like drilling in offshore regions, or maybe we should change the rules for oil speculation as though that will solve the problem. So both the Democrats and the Republicans are pursuing politics rather than real solutions. I think that's likely to continue at least through this election cycle, but beginning within a year or two, I think the economic pain will become so severe that it'll be necessary to start doing something. One thing that I think will be inevitable at some point is actual rationing of gasoline and other fuels. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good thing, rationing by quota. We already have rationing by price, which is very inefficient. It just means that poor people get hit the hardest and the soonest.
Mm.
But we will see rationing, and it'll be necessary to find ways to save fuel for essential purposes.
Which are?
Emergency vehicles, like EMT vehicles and ambulances and fire trucks. If we don't have diesel fuel for vehicles like that, then I think the fabric of society is really going to start coming apart. Ordinary people are going to have to find ways of getting around without personal automobiles, certainly without having one personal automobile all to themselves so they can drive 50 miles each way to their to their job.
Yep.
That way of life is coming to an end. We will see our economies begin to relocalize. You know, we've had globalization over the past couple of decades based on cheap transport fuels. But without cheap transport fuels, we're going to have to make stuff locally.
Yep.
We're going to have to grow our food more locally. And, in fact, I think that's going to be very good for us.
Mm.
It'll be a painful transition because we're going to have to relearn a lot of skills and rebuild a lot of manufacturing infrastructure that we have let go. But in the end, I think it's going to be very good for our communities. It's going to be very good for our young people who are actually going to have some real job opportunities making things and building things and growing food rather than just sitting in front of computer screens.
Oh, yes. But then if you extrapolate further, and I've thought about this because I live in a rural community, a fishing village, you know, I can grow all my vegetables, but I can't grow grains, so I can make bread, but I can grow potatoes and turnips and the like. I can fish because the water's just outside my door and I'm lucky. But I can foresee, I mean, people are going, they're already losing their jobs in the hundreds of thousands in the United States. Now, I think that'll be more a trend than a one-off phenomenon.
Yes.
As oil declines and coal. So what's going to happen to these communities like Denver and you know, which is extrapolated all the way down out to Boulder, and there are these communities way out yonder, and the only way they can get around, there's no public transport.
Mm-hmm.
In their SUVs or, you know, whatever. What's going to happen to all those communities in there? Hundreds of thousands of them all over the United... And I'm just talking now about the United States, but one can extrapolate to the world, yes.
It's going to be a very difficult transition.
Mm.
There's a documentary made 3 or 4 years ago. Actually, I was in it. It's called The End of Suburbia.
Mm.
It's a kind of chilling look at how we've built a whole way of life around the automobile. We designed our cities. We designed our homes around the automobile, that's been a perilous investment, an enormous investment of trillions of dollars in urban design and road building and so on. That's an investment for a world that will no longer exist. So we have to rebuild public transportation infrastructure. We have to rebuild our cities so that people can get around by bicycle and by walking instead of having to get into cars. And this is going to take time. Unfortunately, we've left it too long.
Mm.
And as a result, the transition is going to be very painful. We are going to go through something that will probably look much worse than the Great Depression of the 1930s.
Mm. Shouldn't they start getting into public transport pronto before the oil gets more and more scarce?
Well, of course. And that's what you've just really hit upon, a very important point. While we still have energy that is relatively cheap, we should be using that energy to fund the transition to renewable energy and to a lower energy society.
Yeah.
Because the longer we wait, the less we'll have
to be able to do it.
To invest in that process of transition.
Well, then that takes me on to the next subject, which is part of my area of expertise, nuclear power and the enormous quantities of radioactive waste. Can you imagine? You know, our children, I guess, because it's happening faster than we thought, waking up in the morning, huge quantities of radioactive waste and no way to transport it anywhere or store it because there's very little oil.
That's right. Nuclear power seemed to make sense in a world of cheap energy, easy transportation, and so on. But it's an investment in an energy infrastructure that has no future.
Yeah.
Just from a purely economic standpoint, it's important to recognize that uranium is another depleting non-renewable resource. And according to one study that so far is the best one I believe has ever been conducted, global uranium supplies will probably peak well before 2050. So that's within the time horizon of any nuclear power plant that would be planned today.
Decent, high-quality, concentrated uranium supplies within 10 or 20 years, actually.
Yes.
Yep. But you see, we're in Australia. I'm in Australia at the moment, and we've got 40% of the world's richest uranium we're sitting on. And our government's policy is to dig the stuff up as fast as possible to get the money to export it. Then the radioactive waste is made, out of which you can make bombs as well. And then you've got a much, much bigger problem. So the attitude I find totally immoral of our government at the moment anyway.
Yeah, we need to be thinking about what is our long-range plan.
Yes.
What kind of energy infrastructure will work for many generations to come?
Yes.
And so we have to start with whatever is renewable, because that's the essence of sustainability over many generations.
And that's all here now. Solar, wind are cheap. Geothermal's cheap where it's available. And tidal and all sorts of things, but the money is simply not being invested in those forms of energy under Cheney, and God knows what will happen if Obama's elected, because he's taken $240,000 from Exelon, the nuclear industry in Illinois. How do we get to these people well-intentioned, but as you pointed out, fairly ignorant in the geophysical and biological sciences, to teach them education is the key, don't you, Richard?
Absolutely, and we have to educate both the policymakers and the general public at the same time, because if the policymakers get out ahead of what the public will support, then it just doesn't work for them. But if we're only educating the public, then the policymakers are still living in an older mental paradigm that just doesn't make sense anymore.
Well, we kind of need an FDR of that stature with the vision, the ability to take people forward, to talk to them directly, inspire them, stimulate them, encourage them to tighten their belts, to have rationing for petrol. When I was a child, I was here in Australia in the Second World War. We had rationing tickets for food and for petrol, and that's how we lived, and we were okay.
Yes.
We were okay.
And this is something that we need to understand and should be part of our national and global conversation, and that's the fact that we don't need to be consumers in order to be happy. We've created a way of life based on cheap energy, cheap materials, cheap food, and we've been talked into the belief that the more we have, the happier we'll be.
Yep.
And in fact, the research, the studies, have not supported this at all. Happiness studies that look at how satisfied people are with their lives.
Mm.
When these studies are done across cultures, they show consistently that there's no relationship whatsoever between the amount that people consume, whether it's of energy or other stuff, and how happy they are.
Mm.
So we could have progress, we could have growth, but in different dimensions than what we're used to. We're used to having growth in GDP and progress in terms of having more stuff and bigger cars all the time and driving and flying further. But we could have cultural progress. We could have each generation being more satisfied than the previous, being better educated, more healthy. If we have those as our cultural goals, then we'll be able to make it through this transition, I think, much more easily than if we suddenly find our material aspirations being frustrated by the depletion of the resources that those aspirations are based on.
I'm interviewing Richard Heinberg, Senior Fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. So I think you've talked about addiction, Richard, where we are actually addicts to growth. What is so good about growth anyway, except that the rich get richer? And so it takes me back to those suburban communities out of Denver, just say, as a prototype. How can they get themselves together to become self-sufficient without using cars? I mean, do they need to get cows for milk? This is really serious.
Yes.
Cows for milk? Do they need to start their own vegetable gardens, use permaculture? And in fact, I think you wrote about the fact that in older societies in China, because I was in China before this whole madness developed, they use their own sewage as fertilizers for their fields, which is very obvious. I'm talking now as a physician. It's not dangerous if you treat it properly and the bacteria die and it becomes sterile. So we are throwing away, we now make artificial fertilizers with oil.
That's right.
So we're throwing away the obvious fertilizer that we could all be using to grow the most extraordinary food. So the people in say, a suburban community out of Denver could have their cows and they'd have milk, yogurt, right?
You're absolutely right. A good friend of mine there in Australia is a man named David Holmgren, who's one of the founders of the permaculture movement back in the 1970s.
Yep.
And he actually looks at the suburbs as places of potential abundance.
Yep.
My wife and I actually live in a old inner suburb of Santa Rosa, California, and we have a quarter acre suburban lot, and what we've done is plant about 25 fruit and nut trees. We have a dozen garden beds. We're running our house on solar energy. And you know, our energy footprint is a tiny fraction of that of our neighbors, other people in California, and yet our quality of life is just extraordinary. You know, right now we're talking in late July, and we have peaches and plums and pears and tomatoes coming in, and you know, we're just enjoying an enormous bounty.
Abundance.
This could happen all across suburbia if people simply understand how they could do it.
And no pesticides, right?
Yes, that's
gorgeous,
right.
Gorgeous, clean food. And now what you need too is a plug-in hybrid, Richard, or a plug-in electric car, so that you also channel your solar electricity and charge the car up. So during the day, you're driving with renewable energy, which is what has to happen.
Absolutely. We do need electric cars, and we also need a lot fewer cars.
Yes.
So that's going to require not just a different material technology, but a different social technology. How do we share what we have? Because that's a sure path to using less. How do we share our vehicles? You know, you can double the passenger efficiency of a typical American car just by adding another passenger.
Let alone three more.
That's right. So how do we develop car share networks using perhaps cell phones and computer technology, GPS, so that all you have to do is make a call or go on the computer and a car will show up within a few minutes going basically where you want to go, and it will cost you much less, and it will also cost the environment much less in terms of pollution.
Well, yes, that brings me to the auto industry. I mean, when you think about it, the attitude of getting a new car every few years because it's sexy, and I watch the car ads, and they're all about testosterone, you know, going from 0 to 100 miles an hour in 3 seconds, and it's very sexual, the advertising. But to make a car requires huge amounts of energy to make the steel, to make the plastic, the whole thing. It's so wasteful, and then we throw away the cars we've been using, crush them up.
That's right, and we tend to overlook the fact that the tires on our cars are made with oil, and the roads that we drive on are also made with asphalt, which is an oil product. So as oil becomes more expensive, all of this is also going to get much more expensive. There's really no way out. We have to find ways of using much less and transporting ourselves by public transportation and really just traveling a lot less is what it comes down
to. Riding bicycles, which is good for the cardiovascular system and the musculoskeletal system. Let's go on now. I found the article on food fascinating, the industrialization of food, that only 2% of the U.S. population now grow food, and it's actually all run by Archer Daniels Midlands and Monsanto and, you know, huge corporations, whereas when you get dirt under your fingernails, as you've experienced, and grow your own food, how incredibly deeply fulfilling and satisfying that is. And then you get to hear the birds.
Absolutely.
And look at the sky and the clouds, and you can commune with nature and realize what we've got to do to save this gorgeous planet of ours. So can you just briefly, Precy, where food, the production of food is at, the transportation of food, the amount of oil that's used? Let's go into that area, Richard.
Sure, Heinberg. Yeah. Well, we have created a fossil fuel-based food system. For every calorie of food that we produce in the industrial countries, we invest 10 calories of fossil fuel energy, and that goes into diesel fuel for running tractors and other farm machinery. It also goes into making pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers, which are mostly made from natural gas, and transporting farm inputs and outputs. Altogether, it's a system that is designed to fail in an energy-constrained world. The typical food item on an American plate has traveled 1,500 miles from the farm to get there. So
probably in a refrigerated truck, which uses more energy,
right,
and also damages the ozone. Then it goes to the supermarket and it's all refrigerated, you know, again, using more energy. I mean, it's so artificial, right?
And that supermarket probably has enough food on its shelves to last for about 3 days without being replenished by more trucks showing up. So as we're experiencing diesel fuel shortages around the world, that means that it's getting more and more difficult to maintain those long supply chains. So this is really a survival problem. We need to shorten those supply chains, grow much more of our food locally, and it's going to take a lot more people to do that.
Yep.
During the 20th century, our dominant demographic trend was urbanization, people moving off the farm into the city.
Mm.
And that happened in many cases involuntarily. Even people who wanted to continue farming couldn't do it because they couldn't compete with the cheap, giant agricultural machinery running on cheap, abundant oil. Now, that equation is changing. As we need food produced locally, as we need food produced without petrochemicals, and as the cost of tractor fuel goes up, that means that the economics are in favor of small-scale local production. And the only way that's going to work is if we have lots more people producing food. Now, most of them will just be backyard gardeners, and certainly we need a movement like the Victory Garden movement of World War II, only even more so. But we'll also need a much larger percent of the population engaged in full-time agriculture.
Well, I suppose as the economy collapses, and I think that's what's going to happen, people will lose their jobs, and then they can rejigger their lives and grow their food and help their neighbours, and maybe, you know, over time develop a barter system where they barter supplies and services to each other and develop almost self-sufficient communities. Could you see that happening, Richard Heinberg?
Yes, and it is happening in many countries around the world. There's a movement going on in the UK, in Australia, New Zealand, North America. And it's known by different names in different places. In some places, it's called the transition movement, transition towns, transition villages, and so on. In some places, it's called the relocalization movement. But this is all a very grassroots kind of effort to stimulate local production, especially of food, to stimulate local economies, to help people understand the direction that things need to go in and help them make that transition in their own personal lives. It's a very hopeful trend that I see happening.
Well, it's kind of, I think, exciting. And, you know, one of the main problems with American health at the moment is increasing obesity. And
if
people get out and grow their own food and this awful junk food is less and less available, they'll be healthier, obviously.
Right.
And they'll be riding bicycles and the like.
Unquestionably, we'll be happier and healthier.
Yeah.
And the planet will be better off the sooner we get off fossil fuels. It's the transition that's the thing. Because if we have good rational planning for how we can go about doing this, and if we cooperate as communities and also internationally in getting off of oil, then I think this period of history is something we'll look back to with great, you know, admiration and satisfaction. But if we just let the market sort it out, it's going to be a very, very painful time. A lot of people will be jobless and homeless, and they won't have the skills to grow food. They won't have the skills to make the things that they need and to repair the things that are starting to break down.
Richard Heinberg from the Post Carbon Institute, as you just talked about that catastrophic scenario and things collapsing, societies collapsing, of course the Pentagon is preparing, and the Pentagon is one of the main users of fossil fuel in the United States in an obscene way.
Yeah, as one entity, it is the highest user of fossil fuels.
How much does it? How many gallons does an Abrams tank take? And I think every 15 miles, it has to be refilled.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the exact figure is, but it's measured in gallons per mile rather than miles per gallon.
So the Pentagon are predicting the post-catastrophic world and saying they've got going to be lots more wars. And, of course, they're rubbing their hands together with glee because they like wars. That's why they're there. Isn't that an aberrant approach to what we've been talking about?
Well, of course it is. And, you know, the Pentagon is actually preparing for all of this. They're talking about getting alternative liquid fuels for their jet fighters by turning coal into a liquid fuel. They're investing in all of these things. They understand that oil is getting more expensive and that they have to change how they're operating. But unfortunately, they're not letting the rest of us in on it. This transition is taking place in the Pentagon, but it's not happening in the halls of Congress.
Yeah, but we don't want to get liquid fuels from coal, because that's extraordinarily energy-consuming.
And
the same
with
ethanol, too. You know, we're feeding cars, not people, by growing, 15% of the grain shortly grown in the United States will go to fueling cars?
Yeah, it was a terrible idea.
Terrible.
And both from an ecological standpoint and from an economic and energy standpoint, most of the ethanol producers now in the U.S. are having a very difficult time because the cost of corn has gone so high that even with the high oil prices, they can't make a profit. So it was just not well worked out from a scientific standpoint before we started investing all this money in it.
Well, so from your perspective then, Richard Heinberg, you just said that we have to really get organized in a systematic way to plan immediately for the post-carbon future. Now, so do you have any plans or notions about how to do that? Just let's take the United States, for example, but of course we can extrapolate to China and Canada and Australia and the like.
Well, yes.
That's a big one, I'm sorry. I've chucked you a curveball.
Yeah, the first thing we have to do is adopt an oil depletion protocol, which is basically a form of international quota rationing of the remaining oil. And we should be doing this with all of the fossil fuels.
Mm.
Unless we ration by quota what's left, we will see prices skyrocketing and bankrupting entire national economies. The only way to keep the price down so that we can afford to make the transition in an orderly way is to agree to use less and to pull less of the stuff out of the ground. And once we've done that, then on a national level, we can have quota rationing for individuals. And what we need to be doing at the same time, obviously, is investing enormous sums in renewable energy production and in alternative transportation, in insulating and heating our homes, because there are millions of American homes that where people simply won't be able to afford to heat those homes unless
yes.
they are provided with alternative sources
yes.
of heat and better insulation. So these are enormous priorities.
Enormous.
We
yep.
can't do all of this and fund the Pentagon at the level it is at the same time. I mean, if you look at what all of this is going to cost, it's going to cost hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Where is that money going to come from?
Well,
if
the
you
Pentagon.
Look at the federal budget.
The Pentagon.
the only place in the federal budget that has that kind of money
yeah.
is the Pentagon.
Absolutely. And that's all about killing and not about life enforcing programs.
Right. We talk about security, but, you know, what is actually making America or any country less
mm-hmm.
secure? It's the fact that we've based our lives on sources of energy that are draining away and won't be here for us in the future. So the greatest source of security we could have as nations mm-hmm. is to provide more of our own energy from renewable sources. So that's what we should be investing in and not military hardware.
Yeah. Well, look, Richard Heinberg, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you, and in fact, in a perverse way, exciting, because I see the future as optimistic
so.
And stimulating, desirable to produce better and closer communities and a more fulfilling way of life. So I do really want to thank you for your insight, your vision, your knowledge, your projection of the future, and thank you very much for coming on the program.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Helen. And folks who are listening to this could go to postcarbon.org website. That's the organization that I work with, Post Carbon
yeah.
Institute. And they can find out a great deal more about what we're doing to help this transition away from fossil fuels.
And I must say that Richard Heinberg is the clearest thinker I've come upon. And the papers he writes are just brilliant and so easy to imbibe and understand. So
I really
do invite you to go to his website, which is where this interview came from, actually. Thank you, Richard.
Yes, and thank you for your wonderful and important work, Helen.
Thank you. I've been speaking today with Richard Heinberg, author, columnist, and senior fellow of the Post Carbon Institute. For more information on Richard's work, go to www.richardheinberg.com or postcarbon.org.
Now you're going to hear an excerpt from a speech given by James Sterngold, a freelance writer and journalist who was a domestic and foreign correspondent for the New York Times for 20 years. This speech was part of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute symposium titled 3 Minutes to Midnight, The Impending Threat of Nuclear War, which was held in Washington, D.C., 2004.
I wanted to begin by recalling how I sort of got into my current phase of covering nuclear weapons issues, domestic issues largely, quite extensively. I had actually done just sporadic coverage going back to 93 and 94, when I was based in Tokyo with the New York Times, and I was writing about the first efforts to come up with a nuclear agreement with North Korea. And then I jumped back in somewhat more extensively a few years back when the Wen Ho Lee case was going on, and I learned a new end of the nuclear weapons issue, which was the laboratories and how they operated. And then about a little over a year ago is when I started re-engaging and looking quite extensively at, again, the domestic nuclear weapons policies. And like any reporter, I tried to come up with new ideas all the time and fresh ways to get at the subject. And at one point, I remembered that the justification given for some of the new weapons initiatives that the Bush administration was pushing was that we had this old generation of scientists that had actually built bombs, and they were getting old and retiring, and that this art was being lost, and that they had to bring up a new generation of scientists. And even though we were in an era of supposedly arms control and reductions, that they had to pass on this art from the old generation to the new generation. So I thought, you know what, why don't I go talk to this new generation, find out how they feel about this, and just give some sense of who these people are who are actually going to be doing the designing. And I persuaded the labs to cooperate, and so I met I think 14 or 15 different scientists and had some modest opportunity to pick their brains and learn a little bit about who they were. And I was really struck by one of the first interviews I did, which was with Bruce Goodwin, who runs the weapons design program at the Livermore Laboratory. And I was asking a little bit about just how he felt being a weapons designer and how people he knew responded when he told him that. He said, I'll tell you the truth. When I meet people outside of the weapons community and they ask me what I do, and I tell them, more often than not, they're shocked. They don't even know that the United States still has nuclear weapons. They basically looked at him as a relic of the Cold War, except that he's not an old guy. And they just sort of scratched their heads and said, that's interesting. And actually, talking to the so-called new generation of designers, we're not talking about kids. They were mostly somewhere in the 20s, but it was mostly 30s and 40s, but that was considered the new generation. Not a single one of them had ever studied in any depth the only actual use of atomic weapons, which was obviously in Japan and Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. None of them knew how many had died. None of them knew the history of radiation poisoning and illnesses that were caused by the bombings. And some of them had the jobs at the labs, and they were quite candid about it because a spouse was working nearby, and this happened to fit the schedule with the kids and where they wanted to live. And this was a good job that fit their lifestyles. So obviously that raised the question, if the people who actually made the bombs knew very little about the history and the culture and the context, it's hard to expect really people more broadly in the country to have much of a feel for this. This gets to the point of how much the media can or cannot influence this debate. I do not hold the media blameless. I think there's very little sustained debate in the American media on this subject. Why there is not more is one of those subjects that I put in the category of mystical. I've been a journalist for 23 years, and there simply is no explaining sometimes why an O.J. Simpson can so fascinate America and a $477 billion budget deficit, let's say, or nuclear weapons policy does not. There's some kind of mystical convergence of does take energy from the media to pursue a subject. It does take interest from Congress, usually, to add some fuel to the fire. And it takes something among the public that captures their interest, and there has to be some kind of pull. I certainly have, you know, done my best to try to continue to keep the ball rolling, to come up with, as I was saying before, fresh ways to get at the subject. There aren't that many, and I think this is one of those subjects that the mystical union has not taken place. I see nothing on the horizon that's going to somehow generate a new era of interest and serious debate on our nuclear weapons policy in spite of the many things that you heard today.
That was James Sterngold, a freelance writer and journalist who was a domestic and foreign correspondent for the New York Times for 20 years. This was part of a speech he gave at the Nuclear Policy Research Institute Symposium held in Washington, D.C. in 2004. At the time of the symposium, James Sterngold was national correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Thank you so much for joining us on If You Love This Planet. If you'd like to donate to the show, which we'd greatly appreciate, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.